didn't know him personally very well, but we had been told that he would be sent by the government to Australia to negotiate with the Australian government to allow internees to be released in Australia or to return to the United Kingdom. Major Leighton loomed very large in our life at that time. And looking at a diary under the date of March 25th, 1941, Major Leighton arrives in Australia. We have waited for him for months. Our hopes are very high. This will be the turning point of everything. So I was looking forward to so much, because when I look at this diary, there's very little in it except Major Leighton's movements. He played a very, very large role in our anxiety, in my case, to get back to England.
How about the goods you had stolen from you on the Dunning?
Yes.
Did he do anything about that as well?
Yes, I think he also, he arranged, for lists to be made out and for things to be claimed. It must be said for the government at the time that it was brought up in the House of Commons, and compensation was paid in the midst of wartime. It was decided it would. I don't know when the compensation was actually paid, the dates, but it was discussed and it was taken very seriously in Parliament.
So there you were in this camp, but having high hopes of this man who was coming over.
Yes.
And meanwhile, you'd formed your Boy Scout group.
Yes.
And what other jobs were you doing in the camp?
Well, participating in administrations of Parliament, going to lectures. I was responsible for distributing newspapers. You got.
These camp newspapers.
No. These were not camp newspapers, but normal Sydney or Melbourne newspapers.
And how about your hut, the hut where you live?
Yes.
Who were you with? How many people?
I think we must have been something like 40, but I'm not quite sure. I would have to count it. I was not asked that question for a long time, because all the members of the hut signed, on a memento, these were all young people, or practically all young people. There were two huts, which were comprised out of youngsters, 17, 18, 19 years.
Did the young people get on with the older people? Did you have good relations?
Oh, yes. I don't remember much friction between the age groups.
And were the conditions good? Your sleeping and sanitary conditions in the camp?
Yes. It was... we slept in bunks. Now, of course, I looked at it from the point of view of a 17-year-old, I didn't think of anything sleeping on a straw mattress, in bunks, one on top of another, but, then children do, so it's not something that hit a young man, but it would, of course, the older, very older people, much older, it was, of course, for them much less comfortable. This didn't hurt. It's the monotony of the countryside. But we were taken out of camp from time to time to swim in the Murrumbidgee River. It's interesting, because I spent in the Murrumbidgee many years later, decades later. I was responsible for building a factory in a city also on the Murrumbidgee River called Wagga Wagga. So,
were you given any opportunity for work in Australia? Were you ever asked to go out and do work?
Yes, there were working parties, but the way I remember it, these were voluntary, and volunteered for these working parties, and which were out because they were outside the camp, but they mostly connected, I think, with construction jobs.
Do you remember any outstanding individuals in the camp? You know, you were saying this vast range of talent that was there. Are there any sort of people
who became famous later in the camp, or people who were important to you?
Yes, do you remember any of these? Anyone who's important to you?
Amongst friends. Yes, well, but I haven't got all that many friends dating back from that time, right? I have one friend with whom I've remained close ever since, right? The same age, right? And we meet from time to time. There's also a reunion here of Junera. There is a Junera society here. But it's not very large, quite obviously, because out of the 2,000 people, say 1,000 stayed in Australia, and then people went to different parts of the world, and say a few hundred returned to the United Kingdom. The exact number, so it's I have one particular friend, and then I have a number of acquaintances amongst the people who remained in Australia. Quite a few became prominent in Australian life. For instance, Professor Green of the National University of Canberra, who for some time was economic advisor to the Whitlam government. Judge Strauss in the courts in Victoria. I'm just trying to think back because one often has to remember whether people wanted to know or not. But there were quite a number of people in the media and in political life, in the judiciary, and in the medical profession who made careers. But you know, now, of course, the people who were older, of course, unfortunately, are unlikely to be alive. They would be, as I was 17 and I'm now 72, or so not quite, but shortly 72, the maturer people would, of course, have been older.
What happened to the Nazis? Were they put in the camp with you at Hay?
No, they were put into a different camp. They actually were disembarked in Melbourne. So the camp in which I was, some of the tenants went to number 7 camp in Hay, but the number 8 camp was totally refugees. Which the Australians, of course, never would acknowledge. You know, the Australians said we had agreed to take prisoners of war. Right? We did not agree, right? And this is the reasoning behind their refusal to release any of the internees in Australia until after Major Leighton had been, and then even for some considerable time after. I mean, they were released mostly in Australia, right? Those who had remained in 1943, and to join also in the Australian Labour, to join the Australian Labour Corps.
You were saying, you read out your very high hopes of Major Leighton coming. When he did come, could you tell me about your sort of relationship with him and how it was that you got out of the camp?
Well,
what was the procedure?
The procedure really, he addressed the camp, that friend, he came several times, because he negotiated, and he had to go to Canberra and negotiate with Australian authorities, and therefore, unfortunately, I'm not successful with Australian authorities, which government refused, to release anyone in Australia, there is no shipping space, there's very little shipping space. So we have to allocate to those of you who want to return, we will have to allocate shipping space,
ships that are going to England. So, but of course, you will have preference if you are skilled workers, essential to the war industry, if you join the forces. And so I had already volunteered before I ever went out, right? So I was sent to Australia, so right, I volunteered to join the army, right? And, but you know, the span of time, it took a long time. I mean, we were moved to other camps in Australia, and then in it was in November 1941 that we embarked for England, or Kobovas, was put on a ship called the Stirling Castle, and went back to England, arriving in England, I think, around about in late December, in December, 1941.
And had you committed yourself at that time to
joining the forces?
Oh,
yes, and what choice did they give you? What could you go into?
Well, no choice at all, No choice at all, not until 1943. In 1941, in December 41, and this is in a time but just trying to remember the dates. Just trying to find the date. Actually, in the UK, on the 1st, right, on the 1st of December. 1941.
Yeah. Right, and you had signed on then for what?
I signed on for the Pioneer Corps.
What did you feel about that, going into the Pioneer Corps? Because you've explained that the guards on the boat were members of the Pioneer Corps.
Yes,
but
they had formed separate alien companies in the Pioneer Corps, which was consisted only of aliens, but officered by British officers. These were really alien companies with much higher standard of education, quite obviously, than the kind of troops we had on the Juliara. So,
could you tell me about that? You know, how your initiation into the Pioneer Corps and the training you had.
Well, I wasn't given much time. I arrived in England, back in England, I think, in Hyten. You know, we were at Hyten, but well, I think we left Hyten practically immediately. And I went to London. I arrived in London on the 1st of December 1941. And if I remember correctly, the 7th of December 1941 was Pearl Harbor. You know, I experienced this actually in London. Then the Americans, of course, joined the war, and on the 7th of December, I enlisted in Ilfracombe. As far as I remember, we had to take what we called the King's Shilling at the time, in Hyten already, or rather when we came off the boat in Liverpool, when we arrived back in England. And then I was given leave, and I arrived in I was in London for 1 week, and then I arrived in Ilfracombe on the 9th of December 1941, and I went to a training establishment, Pioneer Corps training establishment, and then was posted, I think, first to 251 Company and then to 74 Company, if I'm not incorrect.
What sort of training were you given?
Well, we were given really more marching training, you know, army discipline, training in army discipline, because to teach you how to dig, or to do laboring jobs, you know, that was training on the job. I mean, I did all kinds of things, from bricklaying to building firewalls, round oil installations. I remember very well doing this in Bristol, where some nights later, in fact, the oil storage tanks were bombed. went aflame, I remember that. I think we were then stationed in Cheltenham. So, what?
And were you content with that? You know, were you pleased to be in the Pioneer Corps?
No.
Or were you wanting to get into other aspects of the...
I was most displeased at the time to be in the Pioneer Corps because as a youngster of 18, by then, I felt that I wanted to participate more actively in the fight against Nazism. So, but of course then it was confined, you know, there was no invasion of Europe. This was 2 years before, but then in 1943, the government policy changed, I volunteered for a number of things, for aptitude training, testing, and at first, I had volunteered for a glider unit, this night tanks, very small tanks which were put into gliders, which were going to be put into gliders, but or intelligence worker. Then I was volunteered for that. Something happened to me, so a wheel ball dropped onto my foot and broke a toe. And I was sent to a convalescent unit. And that saved me from that unit, in fact, because I don't know whether I liked it. Well, I could survive in it, but I was then posted. Taken to the Royal for the Royal Armoured Corps and was sent for training in the 55th Tank Training Regiment at Farnborough, from where I was then posted to the 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars. With whom I then landed in Normandy on the third day of the invasion of Europe, fought. I had a lot of luck in life because I was in A squadron, A's King's Royal Irish Hussars. They were only, the squadron had 20 tanks with 5 men on each tank. There were 100, and out of 100, they were only 10 who were still with us at the end of the war, and I was one of those 10, and in between we had replacements. So,
how about the actual landing? You know, you were saying you were D-Day plus 3, is that right? What was that? Which beach did you land on? On Gove Beach. Yes. What sort of resistance was there when you were landing?
Well, the resistance, this was the third day, we were the first heavier tanks to go ashore, but the resistance on the beachhead had stopped. And in fact, we immediately went, proceeded. I think the first night, let me look now, just 1 second.
Yes, where did you land?
In Port-au-Bazin. And we proceeded to Liga north of Bayeux, on the D-Day. On the third, on the following day, as we moved to Jerusalem. It's interesting because it's a little village called Jerusalem. And then we had lots of experiences.
Did you go right through to Germany? Did you go right through to Germany?
Well, I went through the entire campaign first. The south of Netherlands, we were the leading force to Arnhem, but we couldn't get through to Arnhem at the time, and thereafter to Germany.
Well, what did you know about the disaster at Arnhem, you know, as you were trying to get through? Did you realise the extent of the disaster?
You realised the extent of it at the time. And you were quite well briefed on it. And hurt? It was a tragedy, because, of course, if it had been successful, I think the war would have been shortened quite considerably.
Yes, what tanks were you using? And the German tanks.
They compared reasonably with the American Sherman, but at least in my view, they were no match for the German Tiger tanks. They had, it was really the 88mm gun of the German Tiger tanks, which were, to which our armor was insufficient. I mean, I was knocked out of tanks. So,
you were saying, the decimation of your unit. So you must have been in some very severe fights. Are there any particular ones, tank fights, that you can remember?
Yes, around Aulnay-sur-Rodon. Our regiment was a reconnaissance regiment, which means that when you were in action, you went forward till you met resistance, and when you met resistance, it usually meant that you had casualties. And I remember one incident at Aulnay-sur-Rodon, Mont-Piquant area, actually it's on the road to Cobourg, when my troop was knocked out, three tanks, knocked out, and there were 15 people on the tanks, on my tank, two people got killed. I was a co-driver and gunner at the time, and the man who was sitting next to me, down in the tank, he got out, and he ran straight into German hands, he somehow managed to get afterwards away again, but I never met him again. I really ought to trace him. I was a little bit slower. I set off at first a smoke screen with smoke canisters, and then got out of the tank, and I was lucky to find a trench having been dug just at the side of where the tank had been. So I got into that, and then spent a little time in that trench, keeping my head down, and then I went back into got back to the tank, and got one of my colleagues who was wounded out, and there were two people killed, unfortunately, and then altogether we got seven people together, lines, and I mean, I can still visualize it today. We're creeping along hedges. This is the Bocage country in Normandy, and so we were able to creep along hedges, came into forest, and suddenly there was a clearing. And there was a group of German officers standing there studying their maps, The trouble was that the only one who was armed was myself with a pistol, but nothing else. So, judgment prevailed, and we got rounded, and finally, in the afternoon, progress was very slow because we had to be extremely careful because we had actually penetrated the lines. So then we got into a neighboring gully, we saw a tank at the end of it, one of our tanks at the end of it. So we put a berry, a black berry on a stick. Because it's really right, so that it wouldn't shoot at us. So they started firing, and they started firing. Then they started to realize. colleagues trying to get back. You know, it was so hard. I was sent back and put on a tank again the following day on another tank. So
there must have been a lot of risk of severe burns being in a tank. Was that a fear?
Yes. Oh, yes. But again, you know, in 1944, I was 21, you know, and again, you know, this is, I mean, I the most vivid experience, you know, was brought back recently. We went to Caen, we went over for the D-Day celebrations, and, right, field outside Caen, right? We were stationed, the Canadians had most enormous casualties at the time, the tanks knocked out, and we placed our tanks between the knocked out Canadian tanks. And I remember that yesterday sitting behind the tank, right? Together with my commanding officer. And he asked me, we were looking at maps, and he asked me to go into the turret, right, to get another map out of the tower, out of the tank, and I got back. Right? I was just about to sit down when I noticed he had slumped over, right? And he had been hit and killed instantly by a piece of shrapnel. You know, and it could have been me if I had been sitting there. It's, you know, right? He may well have saved my life by asking me to get something out of the tower. That was a major cell fall, and right? I don't know whether you remember Threlfall Breweries in Newcastle, you know, in the north, right? He came from that family, and he had been through the North African campaign without, and you know, it just, well, that's our luck sometimes.
Is this where you wanted to be in the thick of the
war? You know, having been through the Pioneer Corps, is it being in France in that situation? Is that where you wanted to be, do you think?
I wanted to fight the Germans, but I wanted to be exactly in that situation. It's, but you know, yeah, I mean, these memories, you know, didn't inflict much, much worse things. You know, so.
How about actually going into Germany? You know, did you cross the Rhine and go into Germany? You went right through.
Yes, I
wonder what that was like for you, being a German, to actually invade your own country, as it were.
Right. By that time, I was probably much more English than German. That's right, it was complete. Of course, I tried to educate young people, you know, you cannot imagine very difficult to visualize this attitudes, right, the fanaticism of some people. I came across, I remember also that very clearly when partners, and it was youngsters, they were so-called boomers, young, boy of, I think, it must have been 15, 14 or 15, pointing a pistol at me, was going to shoot us. I jumped down from the tank onto him, took the pistol away, and gave him a hiding. He was more Hitler youth. And then had an argument. We discussed it.
Suppose you had speaking German.
Yes.
That must have been a great advantage in a situation like that, being able to actually talk about it.
Oh, yes. Of course, we talk. Afterwards, at the end of the campaign, I found myself up in the north of England, in Hamburg, and then north of Hamburg, in Flensburg, and we then took our tanks to Berlin to participate in the victory parade.
Yes, could you tell me about the victory parade in Berlin? Could you know when did this happen?
Well, I can give you the precise.
I mean,
the article